morning. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. Rather than kind of give an extemporaneous delivery of the Declaration, it would seem that it's a very fitting morning to remember the Declaration as it was so beautifully collated and written. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. The ULT in Philadelphia is exactly what that declaration says. It is an association of independent thinkers who volunteer and donate in order to keep the activities alive for the general public. December is a wonderful month for considering the whole topic of cycles and cyclic law, and therefore the Sunday presentations are revolving around or are umbrellaed by that particular theme. Next Sunday is December 19th, and the activity that morning will start at 10:30 when the doors open and the book tables available, and then at 11 o'clock next Sunday, as today, there will be a formal presentation. The cycle considered for next Sunday is what happens after death. Wednesdays during the winter season, this association of workers focuses on the ocean of theosophy, at least for this winter. It's a collation of articles by William Q. Judge from the late 1900s. This coming Wednesday night is December 15th. There'll be a volunteer or two here to keep the reference library open in case you have something you'd like to come in and research or prepare for that meeting or another. And the library will be open from 5:30 to 7:30. At 7:45, there will be a more informal study class on the ocean of theosophy. And the topic for this coming Wednesday night, December 15th, focuses on astral senses and astral powers. The book table will also be open before and after that particular class. So again, you can read anything you want in the reference library in the front of the building every Wednesday evening. You can visit the book table and at cost pick up those materials you might need to use in your home, or if you have access to the internet at home or at the library, you can go online to various sites and get straight line theosophical literature to read as well. This week is a special week in that the third Friday of every month during the winter, there is a presentation of work on comparative religion and philosophy. We've had a triptych this autumn that has involved Islam and Judaism. And December 17th, this Friday, the building will open up at 6:30. The class will begin at 7. And the presentation on this third Friday will be Christianity, the Sermon on the Mount. Very timely indeed. So please avail yourself of the little periodical. It's one of the freebies to be had at the book table or in the foyer. And please consider yourself a potential volunteer. There's plenty of ways to keep the movement alive and well, and the basis of unity and similarity of study and fitting oneself to understand the philosophy and take it out into the world in practical applications is open to all of us. Now this morning, keeping in line with the month's theme of cycles and cyclic law, we have a talk entitled, What Happens When We Go to Sleep? And following that formal presentation, there will be ample time for questions and answers and discussion.
Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. See me safely through the night and wake me with the morning's light. Apparently, in the 18th century, when this was written, they didn't know what happened when they went to sleep either. They were asking for protection. Now I lay me down to sleep. At night, in perfect confidence that we are all well cared for. And we take it for granted that when the morning comes, the thread of consciousness on which our life is built will be picked up again where we left it when we went to bed. Where then do we go during sleep? We go where the thoughts and tendencies of our waking days draw us. Not far away from the body or the personality, if our consciousness has been largely centered there during the hours when we were responsible for our thoughts, acts, and deeds. But ranging the starry spaces and achieving the conquests of the soul, if the tendencies of our thoughts and aspirations are heavenwards and divine. Our days and nights afford an illustration of the fact that we can let the body go, and that we can depart from the body and still exist. While we are awake in the daytime, we act outwardly through the organs of the body, which serve to transmit and receive impressions. At night, these activities are stilled, and it is said that we sleep. But how may we know we are conscious during those hours of the night? Because when we wake, we can say, I dreamed. And there is no question as to our identity in that dream. We were conscious of having all of our senses. We had apparently the powers of motion. We could even fly. Notwithstanding the dormant condition of the body in that state we call deep sleep, to conceive that during the greater portion of the night's rest passed in what is known as deepless slumber of the body. We are conscious that our action is of a higher and finer kind than in waking life, that it is possible for us to keep a conscious hold on that action, to bring back into this brain of ours, which we are used during the daytime, the memory of every act on every inner plane of being. The soul, the real man, with all his past experiences, is fully awake when the body is asleep. The nighttime of the soul is the daytime of the body. It is only in exceptional cases, however, that a human being knows that he is conscious all the time. That consciousness can never by any possibility cease. Yet each one can see for himself that if consciousness ever ceased, there would be no possibility of it ever beginning again. We can see continuing consciousness in the fact that we are able to take up each day in our life the work of the day and the weeks before. Many people say they do not dream. Yet everyone knows what is meant when the word dream is mentioned. Theosophy says that not only does everyone dream, everyone's dreams can be divided into one of seven types of dreams. Dreaming, according to Theosophy, is for every human being the portal into that self-knowledge which gives certainty in or out of a body that we are self-conscious perceivers. Once we recognize that man is the inhabitant, not the product of the body, the power of remembering more and more of our nightly experiences can be cultivated. As Job said, in dreams and visions of the night, man is instructed. According to HPB, it is by cultivating the power of what we call dreaming that clairvoyance is developed. In actuality, we know very little about sleep, although we say that we experience it. What we know is that we are getting sleepy. That is, that the body is growing exhausted, but sleep never comes to us. We are awake in the daytime. We are conscious, we think. But our power to see and know when awake is applied almost exclusively to external things of a material kind. So that what we call knowledge, waking knowledge, is practically an application of all our powers to physical existence. And to that alone, when we sleep, what takes place? During that interval, we know that the body is absolutely irresponsive in regard to anything external. We do not know nor feel anything that happens to our friends. The most frightful calamities may occur around and about us, and we would know nothing about them until we resumed control of the body. Yet we must have been alive, conscious, with an unchanged identity. This brings our mind to the question as to why or how is it that we know nothing when awake of that activity on higher and altogether different planes during the deep sleep of the body. We have within us, in abeyance but not forgotten, and not inaccessible, all that knowledge. It is recorded, impacted in our imperishable nature as truly as any record can possibly be made. Everything that we have been through, every degree of experience, of knowledge that we have ever acquired. When we sleep, that is when our body sleeps, we go back to that fountain of knowledge which is within ourselves, and wake up in the morning none the wiser. How can that be? Possessing such knowledge, possessing the powers that belong to the immortal spirit, to divine intelligence, we nevertheless cannot use them, are not even aware of their existence in us. It is evident to all that every 24 hours we pass through two states, the waking and the sleeping. But Theosophy goes further and teaches that the sleeping period is divided into two states, designated as the dream state and the state of dreamless sleep. Thus all men pass through and live upon three planes of life and consciousness every time the earth makes one revolution upon its axis. The connecting link between these three planes or states of consciousness is the immortal soul itself. Because of this ever-present link, the three planes of human life do not and cannot stand. stand isolated from one another. Herein lies the importance of sleep and dreams. The waking state is influenced by the sleeping states, and the sleeping states are profoundly affected by the waking condition. So that an understanding of all three states and their interrelationship becomes of prime importance for all earnest students. One of the chief objects of the science of devotion, as it is called the Bhagavad Gita, is to obtain complete control over the lower nature. The first step in the attainment of such control is dependent upon an understanding of the nature of life during sleep and waking and their effects upon one another for good and for evil. And from a lesser known but obvious philosopher, Jackie Gleason, our dreams are first-hand creations. We have the past, we have the capacity for infinite creativity. At least while dreaming, we partake of the power of the Spirit, the infinite Godhead that created the cosmos. Topic: what happens when we go to sleep?
Frequently we've heard in these rooms an invitation to open our minds and to suspend our past belief systems and the premises, the postulates upon which we've been raised and we function frequently. And the tickle this morning is to consider, each of us, what are some of the postulates that we have come into the exploration of this philosophy with. Well, probably, in analogy, many of us spent a goodly amount of time this morning getting ready for the day. You know, in terms of appearance and grooming and nourishing and selecting outfits and figuring out the weather, and lots of focus, lots of concentration on getting ready for Jagrata, the waking day. And the greatest irony probably is we do that without much thought. It's what we've been raised to do. It's our postulate that the day is very, very important. But how many Westerners spend an equal and opposite amount of time, instead of planning for the external in the AM, an equal and opposite amount of time of planning for the internal in the PM? So that's one cycle that we probably do not consider much, but that has tremendous impact on existence and activity. Now, I'm sure that you came to these rooms today with thoughts and or perhaps the talk sparked something for you. Yes?
Well, at the very beginning, I remember as a child being asked to say that before we went to sleep.
Yeah.
And we always wondered, why, Mom? Why? Because it doesn't make any sense. But what it gave us was a devotion, something or a yearning to know what's in that darkness. It did something, because we've always wondered and questioned, and I guess that's how I found ourselves here.
So that nighttime ritual, that childhood cycle, now I lay me down to sleep, was comforting, but also evoked some long-lasting questions about what happens after sleep. And it's an interesting, the opening lines of now I lay me down to sleep. I, the eternal ego, the soul, the true beingness that is our divine reality, lay me, the personality, the busyness of the lower mind, the passions and desires, lay that down. And in that we have the very, very ancient notion that the nighttime is really the daytime of the soul. Yes?
Well, we think the basic it's completely different. No one has ever told us there's anything to prepare for. So obviously you don't mean the grooming and the outfits.
Mm-hmm.
What is the preparation then we should be doing for the nighttime?
What is the preparation we should be doing for the nighttime? Well, the preparation is probably the entire activity of the day in a certain way. But if we consider the preparation for the nighttime, we actually have a framework of how we can use the physical brain and how we can use the senses to bring back more of that font of sweet spirituality that we bask in the nighttime hours as pure soul. And that becomes crucial, that a student prepared the sevenfold division of dreams. And this is available free to everyone at the book table. Please pick one up for yourself for home use. As we prepare ourselves for the dream state and the dreamless state, we set up certain influences or causes in which these sevenfold varieties of dreams can come through. So if we're preparing in Jagrata, the waking state, we're preparing for two sleep states. One is called in the East Svapna, which is the dream state. The other, Shushupti, which is the deep sleep. And we begin to prepare that by our modes of thinking. So we know that during the day, our desire or our goal may very well be, the motive may be to lead a high spiritual life and to bring our mind and our soul and our emotions back to a centered well of theosophy. Pure altruism may be the golden rule, but to begin to use that as often as we can through the day. At the end of the day, to prepare for the dream state, we might consider focusing. So from the use of mind, we might consider an idea. We may calm the mind and focus it and put it on a philosophical, lofty notion, as high as we can envision. And for some of us, that would include a period of centering and meditation. For some of us, that might include a spiritually arousing song or psalm. For others of us, it may be the reading of an inspirational scripture. It may be all of those things for some of us. In other cultures, the aroma of herbs may be used. But we know that we can do this in the same way that we dim a room. We make the room as calm and peaceful as possible. We pull the drape so that there's no extraneous light. We try to ensure that the bed chamber is silent and quiet and peaceful. We try to regulate the temperature. All of those preparations become very, very, very focused and very philosophical if we allow it. In terms of using our astral senses, we might prepare in those final moments before sleep, imagining, envisioning what it would be like to have a spiritual guide, a spiritual companion who could help us in transitional states. We might imagine what it would be like if I could recall my dreams and record them in the morning. And what would it be like if I had enough of those dreams recollected, recorded, and then I could begin to see the symbology, the language of the soul that would be repetitive, that would build, that would come through to me, maybe in analogy, maybe in metaphor. But what would life be like? Could we imagine what we could accomplish for the good of others if we were able to have the concentration of mind, to have the concentration of spirit, to bring that through. And so we would lay ourselves down with a particular compassionate feeling of, I'm now about to embark on a spiritual journey. This is the beginning of the day for the soul. And as soul, I wish, I have a motive to be able to move through the dreaming states into the deep sleep states, back again through a dreaming cycle, back into Jagrata, the waking cycle, with inspirational knowledge, with a sense of wisdom that I can bring to the service of others. That preparation would make for a very, very different sleep state. Yeah.
In the latter part of the 19th century, especially when these teachings were springing out, there are many stories of some of the greatest scientists known to us who were not necessarily, as far as we know, attending lectures. Edison was one.
Mm-hmm.
And there are stories of him stopping in his laboratory, clearing the desk, and climbing up on it and laying down to go to sleep. Well, usually when they woke up, they probably had a vision that was not related directly with what they were trying to figure out in the laboratory. But they knew enough to sleep on it, and they brought that back, and we have the incandescent electric light bulb. Now we don't know what he dreamed about. Probably not even about electric.
All right, let's consider. For the scientist, and there are many stories, the developer of the sewing machine, the developer of Velcro, there's so many different inventors who have written that they consistently went to bed with a fixation on a question or a problem, or musicians and artists who use their waking state to really become totally imbued. They're intrigued by a particular problem or application. And so they've held this daytime meditation with tremendous intensity of will and imagination and thought. They go to sleep with the same kind of concern, if you will. And lo and behold, upon arising, they have a sense of how to fix that. It's fun if you search the internet for famous quotes on sleep and dreaming. And one of them was from Edgar Cayce, and it fits with what the comment just was. Dreams are today's answers to tomorrow's questions. Edgar Cayce. So that sometimes when we have one of these kinds of dreams that stays with us, and we can recall what the dream was, and it's got a puzzling reality to it, but it stays with us like this aroma of something really fine. It helps to jot that down so it's not lost in the hurly-burly thought of the day's activities. Because, as Cayce said, as Gleason said, as all these people said, there's so many different ways that we're pondering something. We may not have even quite formulated the question yet. The answer begins to bubble up. We get little visions or little sparks of what the answer may be. If we keep track of all these little nuggets and look at them for ourselves, the truth will shine through eventually. Your hand was up. Oh, okay. You have a follow through?
We were listening to that comment. You mean to say that we get the answer before we even ask the question?
According to someone like Cayce, we may not, in our lower mind, in that physicality, that material focus of mind that we use, we may not be fully aware of what the question is. You know, how often in daily life do we, you know, we're trying to do better. We're trying to refine character, and we're working on the personality and trying to see how can I be more ethical, how can I apply the golden rule in a good way. And we think we've got an answer, we think we've developed an insight to the answer. And then the more we think about it, it's like pulling the thread out of an unraveling sweater. The thread keeps coming and coming and coming. And in some ways, that questioning may be incomplete yet. But we are living as soul in a very pure, ethereal state during that deep sleep when there's tremendous clarity. When there's tremendous clarity of understanding and insight, all the perceptive possibilities we can imagine. And it's there. We're just having trouble bringing it through the sleeping states from that deep sleep, full awareness, down through the dreams, back into waking day. Yeah.
Well, we were thinking the Tibetans had an explanation for the fact why we haven't thought of the question yet. The word for mind in Tibet is heart. In other words, you think with your heart, you act on the basis of your mind. So in our hearts, we already have the question. We're just not paying attention to that side of ourselves. We're paying attention to the practical, day-to-day, external living. If we'd listen more to our hearts, then we would probably have the question ready.
And frequently, in that day-to-day hubbub, that the din of all the different noise of that lower mind, stream of consciousness, all these intrusive kinds of thoughts that we really wouldn't entertain were we in full command of mind, the universe speaks. Spirituality speaks. There is the potential, the power within, in I to perceive it, but that I may be all mixed up with the me, with the personality and that din. And therefore, if we have a question, you know, gee, how could I help this particular individual help themselves? And we begin to think about it. If we can become clear and open and responsive to the universe, we find within our environments. On the radio, we might catch just the right lyric to a song, or we might hear a commentator on TV saying something a little out of the ordinary, or perhaps a person on the bus, or in a waiting room, or in the food store, or at the office. Something happens. We might catch a glimpse of a magazine article, but the answers begin to pop up if we're open and centered as soul, centered with a heart that's pure, then we can perceive all these things using mind, using our thinking potential. Yes?
Well, all right. We understand where we could be questioning something that we need to solve, but we're still a little confused. Where are these answers?
Where are the answers kept? What premise do we have? Well, we're frequently hearing in these rooms three propositions, aren't we? Three fundamental points by which we can begin to think about human beings and the true nature of the universe and how the humans and the universe are actually oneness. And as part of that postulate system, we know or we're informed about a premise that there is oneness behind all manifestation. In that eternal soul of oneness that emanates or radiates and picks up a human frame and the human constitution, there is an aspect of soul called buddhi. So there's the oneness of the source of the soul, divine spirituality. There is an aspect to that eternal oneness that's called buddhi, the incredible storehouse of wisdom, if you will. And then there is the aspect of mind, of the creative force, of bringing that forward into the human plane that we share. As we move through from waking state, where that eternal is enmeshed in the seven vehicles or the instrumentation of physical life, as we lay that down to sleep and become the I, that mind being, that essence of pure soul and pure perceiver, we move through transitional states of consciousness to the point where existence is in that Buddhi and the closest we can imagine to an aspect of an absolute. And it's there in that compassionate Buddhi side of what is eternal that all wisdom pertaining to that particular soul on its pilgrim's path, pertaining to the collectivity of soul using that human experience at the moment, all of that is as a font. It's there as a resource, as a tapping. We're literally having a reunion spiritually. And the key would be, if that's the reality and that's the collectivity and the oneness and the diversity of spirituality, how can we, as individual emanations of the divine, bring that down and through the instruments that we use at this plane? Yeah.
However, it's and it's mentioned in the teaching, we have to go to court before we can get that wire. Even though we're going to sleep, we still have to go to the Supreme Court, because many people tell about how all of the things that they themselves may be guilty of or haven't been able to perfect pass through the mind like a nightmare. And they say that that's the basis
Hmm.
So before we can even go further,
well,
we have to pass through that, run the gauntlet, as you say?
If we use the notion of a Supreme Court, what comes to this brain is the notion of an external panel of individuals chosen for their prowess in logic and in law, and standing in judgment of. And perhaps there'll be more reactions in the room, but the initial reaction here is that's an awfully lot to put on an external, that there's this power or panel where we have to run the gauntlet and be judged. Let's try it from a different point of view. If we premise that we are emanations or radiations, or we are soul, and that soul is like a sunbeam that leads back to the sunshine. We are soul that are like beams of spirit, if you will. Then there's no external force, there's no panel of judges, that there's no gauntlet that we're running that is external. What is key is our perception and our individual ability to perceive and see. There was a wonderful quote. We know that in the Gita, there is a blind sage called Dhritarashtra. And there's often in legend and glyph these blind seers who, although they don't have physical vision on this plane, that astral sense and that spiritual vision is pure and very, very capable. That's what we're really trying for. And in many ways, our perceptions that we hold, the way that we identify ourselves, becomes the gauntlet. That becomes the Supreme Court, but it's internal. It's our own process of heart and mind holding a particular image of identity, and then that can limit us or not. There's a little quote from Stevie Wonder, who frequently says, you know, I see that. And someone finally asked him, what does he mean when he says he can see? Although he's totally blind, he believes his mind helps create the same images that sighted people have. You can touch someone and you get a really good picture in your mind. I assume that when you see something, you see it right in front of you, but also it's in your mind, your mind's eye. It's no longer coming from your eyes. It's coming from inside. I touch certain things so that in my mind, that visual thing is closer to being tangible than intangible. And key to that kind of vision is that internal astral vision, those senses that we use in transitional states of consciousness and certainly in deep sleep. Yeah.
Well, the analogy of the Supreme Court is very interesting because you just mentioned the astral, because that's the gauntlet we must run every night, because it is filled with all those passions and desires and all the things of that day or even days before that we have to pass through and get to that deep sleep state. But even more so, we've got to come back through it again to get back here. And we always wondered, the moment we become conscious on this plane, you know, what goes through our mind? You know, it's like an impulse to go, to move forward, to get to begin the day. And we've heard in these rooms that really the first thing we should do is quiet the mind and reflect on the and on that night's activity. Well, that is perhaps one of the most difficult things to do, because when you're coming from sleep, you're like groggy, or you don't know where you are. You're sort of in that, and then you're asked to be quiet. You know, well, I fall back to sleep, or I'm, you know, or you just can't sit. Now you want to go. You want to move forward. We just thought that was an interesting observation. It hasn't gone any further than that.
Well, let's use that observation together with the Stevie Wonder quote. For Stevie Wonder to be able to talk about the mind's eye and those astral perceptions, notice the process that he's doing is analogous to what we might be able to do pre and post sleep state. He first has a motive where he really wants to see and to literally be in touch with what's before him. And that motive, that focused calm, must intensify. He reaches out to touch it. So he's literally in that moment a spiritual entity using an astral perception, using a compassionate spiritual heart, desiring to be in touch with this plane. And then he chooses the kinesthetic to actually move a form and go with that. If we were to use that same kind of process so it becomes habitual, and for most of us, you know, if we run over the day too long, for some in our population, it's watching TV and using electronics way, way too long during the day, or drinking caffeine or eating chocolate, or the food is just all wrong too late in the day. Or for some of us, it's a nighttime job where we're really pumped and exhilarated by the environment late in the day, and therefore it's hard to relax. But if we made a habitual cyclic effort to go through a process similar to what Stevie Wonder is describing, oneness, a focused calm, a heartfelt, wise, altruistic wish to move through the astral, not get tangled up in it, go into the deep sleep. If we did that in a calm way upon sleep, and then in the morning, reverse it so that in the dawn's early light, when we're just aware that we're in existence, if there were some motion or object, maybe it's a pen and a notebook by the bedstand. Maybe it's the touch of a particular pillow. Maybe we can envision a particular face or phrase and try with great effort to use that as a focus so that as we begin to touch the fourth plane, the material world, we're again focused. And it said if we do the habit of jotting whatever we can remember, that drowsy half sleep where we're really disoriented, I guess, is what the observer was relating. In that orientation, it may just be a word or two. It may be a number. It might be a sense of a color. It may be a little sketch of an object that we're still holding on to. It doesn't have to be much, just something. We keep that log. It may very well be that mind's eye and those visions of the night will begin to clarify with practice across time. Yeah.
Well, they are scientifically proving about cycles that it takes 21 days or 3/7
mm-hmm.
to establish a new routine. Well, one of the things that we're told, especially as we get older, is don't get up until you've done some stretching.
Yeah.
Because it allows your body to then circulate energy and blood, and the nerves wake up. So you're better off if you do some stretching before you get out of bed. Well, we can also do that exactly the way you were saying. Do this internal, mental, heartfelt stretching. What are we here for? What are we about? So we jot down these notes, but we also call all of our nature into conscious activity if we can. But we did want to say, you talked about having a pure heart. Well, I don't. Mine is kind of plaid, I think. It's pure in some
It could
areas.
Be polka dotted in Swiss cheese,
well,
too, so
yeah.
Be grateful.
I mean, it's a mess in other areas. And I realize that's where my effort has to be. But in order to make that effort, I have to call upon the part of me that I do see that is more pure. So that's my Supreme Court. That's where I realize I am the judge and the jury, and I'm also the one who suffers the punishment. So it's a real incentive to clean up your act.
You know, the brain research for many in the room, when we were in school, there was very little brain research that stood behind how lessons were delivered. And in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been so much more, maybe 25 years, far more brain research. And the speaker alluded to an amazing cycle of 21 days for new habit formation. For children and pets, it's 3 days. For the adult, it's 21 days. And that follows so many different things we read about in Shakespeare and philosophy. It's a remarkable thing. But in habit formation, because that's what we're really talking about, in order to get in touch with these seven kinds of dreams and to begin to refine our recollection of the dreams, we're talking about setting up new habits. And, you know, we all chuckled about, well, at least the memory's not polka-dotted or my motives aren't Swiss cheese or, you know, what our flaws. We know if we spend more attention on an animal or a child when we catch them being bad, we're actually reinforcing that trait in that other individual. Because that behavior gets them attention, it's a reward system, they'll do it again. And if that kind of reinforcement is intermittent, it's random, so they never know when the reward is coming, that habit becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. So if we reverse that, if we catch a child or an animal being good and we reward that and we begin to build on that and make that reinforced intermittently, that's what blooms and grows. So we extinguish or starve the negative and we nurture or nourish the positive. And we can do the same thing with our wish, our desire, and our fine-tuning of our instruments to bring back the dreams. But the seven dreams are like a ladder, the seven kinds of dreams. And I really highly recommend the little handout that was prepared. We can, by practice, catch ourselves being good. The evening when we are able to center and calm and raise our consciousness at this plane, and the morning where we're able to stretch spiritually far behind this bed is lumpy and I better get to that bathroom. We want to stretch far beyond that spiritually in order to focus as we can on these remnants of the deep sleep of the night before. Yeah.
I've been coming to these rooms for a long time and finally have confirmed that it was my parents' fault that I was bad.
Oh, nice trick there, boy. But as a small child, we had the parents who were divinely suited for the development of our souls. We karmically deserved to be born into an era, my friends, when not much brain research was available. And lo and behold, out of that manure, here we sit trying to bloom together. A garden of humanity. And sometimes it's because of the shortcomings and the pain and the angst that these bubbles of inquisitiveness, this reminiscence of past knowledge, acts almost like a magnet. And we begin to seek and to search, and we begin to find these ancient scriptures and comparative legends and all this wisdom. So if we could do it, no matter how our parents messed us up, then as thinking adults, imagine how much we can accomplish if only we can stretch these old bones and go with it. Oh, there's a person in a turquoise shirt right here.
I wonder whether this is totally different topic here. It's still the topic of the day. Whether anyone has tried to do any research on the seven states of sleep or dream in conjunction with what's being done on brain research, sleep research, the various states of sleep, whether anybody has tried to correlate those.
There is a lot of medical research on brain function. There's a lot of research being done on rapid eye movement and the starvation of the physical brain when there's no period of rapid eye movement, there's no REM coming in and out. There's a lot of research being done on all sorts of sleep disorders, what happens with sleep apnea when oxygen is a deprivation and what's being recalled. There is a lot of electric and magnetic research being done with things like epilepsy, where the definitive testing for epilepsy, no matter whether it's an infant or an adult, is to wire the body up with electrodes so that the brain scans and the vibrations are being measured in the transitional states of consciousness. And we would call it astral. In the medical profession, they're calling it, you know, transitional states or REM. And they correlate brain function at that level with what goes on in what should be a conscious state during the day. So there's all sorts of medical research being done. And also, when you look at these sevenfold divisions of dreams, now granted, This was relatively new to the Western Hemisphere 130 years ago or so. The lowest, most dense, and most confusing form of dreams is that there are dreams which are mere fancies and they're chaotic pictures. There's a lot of research going on now that talks about the foods that we eat, the chemicals we take in, and frankly, 130 years ago, when this philosophy was being revived in the West, the chaotic pictures are caused by indigestion, difficulty in breathing, what is sleep apnea, or such like physiological causes, which create a feeling of oppression and produce a sensation of impending calamity. There are those among us, among the aging baby boomers and beyond, who are now experiencing remarkable sleep disorders in which, in coming back through the astral states, coming back through the dreaming states in the morning, the physical body is not paralyzed. Should be, but it is not. And that sense of impending calamity, there's somebody out to get me, they're going to kill me, etc., that movement through running the gauntlet, literally, of the astral in such a person, in such a patient, the body's moving and acting it out. They may even be yelling and screaming and fighting verbally as well as physically. And there's a lot being observed about that. So we can go right through all of these types. If the highest form of the sevenfold division of dreams, the purest we can imagine bringing back would be called prophetic dreams, impressed by the higher self directly on our memory. Notice the kinship to the Stevie Wonder quote, that it's that mind's eye and it's the mind that's impressing from within without. Prophetic dreams are generally plain and clear. Either a voice is heard or a coming event is foreseen. The clearer the brain, the more porous it is to spiritual influences, the more vivid will be the remembrance. Truly prophetic dreams are had by certain persons, quote, because their physical brains and the memory are in close relation and sympathy with their higher ego than in the generality of men. The ego's soul, that eternal eye perceiver, has more facilities for impressing upon the physical shell and memory that which is of importance to such persons than it has in the case of other less gifted persons. Now, this doesn't mean they had great parents. It doesn't mean that a Supreme Court panel gifted certain souls with a prowess. But notice what it does mean, that where the brain, where the lower mind is turned consistently in jagrata during the waking hours, turned more and more to spiritual influences, where that brain is more and more used and the lower mind and emotions are more and more centered in the spiritual heart, the font, the vision, the continuity of soul, regardless of the state of consciousness, that continuity of soul grows stronger and stronger and stronger with practice, with nourishing, with repetitive cycles, until gradually prophetic vision, the consciousness is one across time, space, states of consciousness, and is most capable of helping each and all. And that's, my friend, the end of the time we have for this morning. But please, please, out front are free periodicals. They're wonderful little journals, Theosophical Independence, and a brand new production by a student in which you can look at what the seven kind of dreams are. Have a great week, and don't blame Mom and Dad.